You're listening to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and WPKN.org, streaming around the world live. I'm Richard Epstein. This show is sometimes classical. And bing, it's 2 o'clock, which means it's time for me to talk with Maria Schneider, who has composed the music behind us here. What you heard before that was Blues in the Bottle from Stan Getz, and a little bit of Leos Janacek's The Cunning Little Vixen, which is a wonderful title, but nice music, too. So let's see if all goes well. Maria, are you there in the background?
I am here.
Excellent. Okay, the foreground now. Welcome. We've spoken before a couple of times, and I'm really excited to see this new release you've got. I did a digital download. I'm a member of the Artist Share, and I just love getting all your information about how you're producing these things. It is so cool.
Well, thank you so much.
So the name of this album is Data Lords, and the introduction, let's see if I can load that down there. Sorry. Just give me a moment. I've got the... There you go. I don't have the physical CD, so I have the thing on the computer here. The introduction says it's a story of two worlds. One clutters the mind. The other clears it. One seduces and exploits. The other nurtures. One ultimately isolates. The other truly connects. One clamors for our attention. The other simply awaits it. One force feeds answers, the other inspires questions. One manipulates our thoughts, the other grants freedom of thought. And is that your writing too?
It is.
Ah.
Yep. Those I wrote those little couplets after just experiencing what this digital deluge of information and, you know, sort of mind manipulation is doing to everyone, me included. And what, when I pull away from it and I try to re-enter that kind of space that I remember before the days of email and the information deluge, I remember the space in my mind and the time I had to think, and I remember what it feels like even to be bored, but out of that boredom coming, you know, amazing ideas and, you know, how my imagination would get sparked.
Absolutely, and you know, what timing to have this released at this period where we can't all just face each other and smile at each other. You know, you have to lower your mask for a moment or look at the eyes to see the crinkles there to know that someone is really happy about it. And, and as a matter of fact, just before I phoned you, I went to our little phone bank here at the station, and golly, I couldn't get it to work. And so I ran down the hall. And of course, someone had to reboot it, and it finally. And that seems to be life now. You know, you everything needs a reboot to start thinking. And
I think you know, in these times, you know, on one hand, we're finding ourselves needing so much of the technology. I mean, on one hand, Zoom and, you know, all these things have enabled people to work from home, to connect with families, you know, all sorts of really magnificent things. But even that has made us connect in, I think, kind of a deeper way, because we're enjoying looking at each other face to face as opposed to just, you know, on a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're appreciating that connection. But at the same time, I know that people that I'm talking to are loving gardening and doing projects, you know, where they turn everything off and they just kind of re-enter space again, you know?
Well, I'm a gardener myself, and I always say that's the only truly Zen place that I'd spend time in. You know, when I'm playing music, yeah, I'm Zen, but I have to pay a lot of attention and communicate at the same time. But when I'm, I guess, talking to the flowers and the weeds in my head, it's the only place where that doesn't intrude. And you know, I know you have kids, I have kids, and they like me to text them. And I like to talk to them, and it's a very difficult communication barrier there that I want to hear a voice. And I guess last time when I was trying to arrange this, you had a child who was going to have a baby, right? Did that ever happen?
I have stepkids. You okay. know, rather recently, and they're hardly kids; they're in their 30s. Yeah, so the oldest one just had a child, and yeah, it's pretty amazing to have a baby in the middle of all of this.
Yeah, and I mean, were people allowed to go into the hospital or nursery or everybody?
Oh no!
Oh my! Oh my!
Her husband, yes, but not anybody else.
So, you know, I know you've been. Talking about great big data and all its manifestations for a very long time. One of the places where you've been talking about it is how music is disseminated these days. And I know I downloaded this from the internet, and I was going to bring it up here. I put it on a CD. I thought all of a sudden I realized I downloaded it in the wrong format. Couldn't put it on a CD, but, you know, there are a lot of ways to listen now. And what you offer for the people who follow you is a way to download it in various amounts of information that get more and more precise, right?
And so the whole model of Artist Share is that, first of all, the artist owns their own work. Mm-hmm. And that they share the creative process. So one of the things, so everybody who buys through the website, or even if they were to buy the album at the concert, they would have a card in there with a number that is theirs only, that enables them to have an account. And then when they log into, in this case, the Data Lords project, they can see all sorts of videos from when we rehearsed the music, when I was, you know, going back to the drawing board, writing music, talking about what I didn't like, what I wanted to change, everything, you know. And then the final thing is the album.
Yeah.
And some people get it mail order, some people get it download. And the ones who get it download get MP3s, waves that are at the same degree of the same hertz as a CD. But then we also did high resolution, which is more than twice the resolution of a CD. And we did FLAC, downloadable FLAC files. And those sound extraordinary. Honestly, when I listen, I feel like I'm standing in front of the band, you know. And so a lot of people are, and even if you get the mail order CD, you can get that. You know, you can download those extra high quality files. And it's really fun to share that. What's really painful is when I find it file shared on the internet, you know, through sites from all over the world. And it's so honestly heartbreaking, because an album like this, I put years into it. The budget for it, I invested around $250,000. I took out, you know, a huge loan for this, you know. And then when you find people just sharing it so that people can get it for free, it's like, oh my God, who are these people? Who are these companies? What are they thinking? You know, don't they know? And I guess they don't know.
No.
Or they do, and they would just want to look the other way. It's really sad.
Well, I had no idea that you personally invest in it and then just have everybody, you know, sort of compensate you for it. But wow, that's
well, okay. So here's something that you and your listeners likely don't know, and it's something to really for more people to talk about. Most music, even that's on a record label now, is being paid for by the artist.
Mm-hmm.
Most record companies are not paying the budgets of making records anymore. And why not? Because it's financial death to do it, you know. So like on through ArtistShare, I've found a way to manage to do it because I set my own price based on my cost. I have, you know, of course it becomes more difficult when people illegally file share it. But, you know, I've managed to do very expensive recordings. But nowadays, everybody feels kind of like they have to be on Spotify. And what happened is there was such a deluge of everybody's music being put up, you know, just like a tsunami of music being put up on YouTube, most of it illegal. And, you know, people couldn't fight it. It's an impossible battle for many, many people to keep their music off of YouTube. And so, and everybody start, but people listening to music, your average person, when they want to hear something, the first thing they do is go to YouTube to check it out. And if it's there, of course they don't buy it.
Right.
So people got used to getting music for free. So then Spotify comes along as kind of the supposedly legitimate place to get music, you know, mm-hmm. and because they were trying to get people to pay $9.99 a month.
Yeah.
Well, most of their people don't. They watch ads instead. But so, and the amount of money people are making is peanuts.
Yeah.
Here's a figure for you. 90% of the music on Spotify is having to split 1% of the financial pie. So you know the music that's not really making money on Spotify is all the music that you probably play on your show. Classical music, jazz, you know.
Oh, world. I play all sorts of things. For, you know, I mean, First of all, I pay for Spotify. I always have. And, you know, I feel bad talking about this because it's my way of searching the world, of getting to music that I would never, ever hear without having to buy it first. And I don't download it, but
of course, you know, the thing is I believe that most people do want the artist to be paid.
Oh, absolutely.
And I believe,
yeah.
I wish
yeah.
that the model of Spotify, instead of everybody being paid exactly the same little tiny increment of 0.0007
yeah.
cents per play, that we could set our own price. Because as it is, my record costs $250,000. There'll be another kid who makes a recording in his bedroom that costs
right.
almost nothing.
Yeah, a quarter.
And we're being priced the same. We're not allowed to be part of the free market
right.
where we set our price according to our costs and our audience size.
So
it's a crazy, crazy world economically for creators right now.
Yeah. No, I understand, and I really empathize with it because I've talked to all sorts of musicians over the years, and I hear this, and it's terrible that you know, and the kid who does it in his room is downloading electronic versions of instruments, and you're dealing with real people who have to,
of course,
sit,
yeah.
you know, and lots of things. Is there a solution? Is there something?
Yes.
Yeah.
There is. The solution is people being able to set their own price. You know, that I'm allowed to make my music free if I want to, or make it. You know, that there's, you know, if on a streaming service, you know, if somebody could say, yeah, you can listen to my music, you know, half of each piece for free the first time. If you want to continue, mm-hmm. you have to pay this.
Yeah.
If you want to download it, you have to pay this or whatever. And let the market decide, like you say, you would pay,
oh,
you know.
Absolutely, you know.
But on the other hand, it's a great place for discovery, as you just said. So,
oh.
you know, people could then kind of feel out their market and have it be something legitimate. But, you know, music is not free to make. And when the record companies brag about how much the industry has made,
mm-hmm.
well, yes, of course, because they're not footing the bill of most of these records. The artist is, with a zero chance of a return, most of them, the vast majority of them.
Mm.
So this is a real problem.
Yeah, I mean, I you opened my eyes to that last time we spoke, which was a while ago, and I really started thinking about it and talking to other people, and wow, it is hard, you know. So it's this technology is such a double-edged sword. It, you know, it has such advantages and such a chance to leave people and real musicians and in the dust. But at any rate, look.
Well, it's when there isn't the proper controls, when there isn't the proper regulation. I mean, we're seeing this now in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yes.
Thankfully, it's taken way too long for them to look at companies like Amazon and Google and, you know, these various companies and look at them and Facebook for antitrust.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon, oh, my God, don't even get me going. I mean, look, in the time of COVID, how many small businesses are literally evaporating?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Amazon goes through the roof for its shareholders and Jeff Bezos. You know, that tells you something. What is king in this economy? Data. Data wins every time.
Yep.
So, so there has to be some regulations on big data companies. Otherwise, nobody can compete. It'll just be a few small companies divvying out the money to everybody, you know, and that's not America. You know, that's not a free market.
No, it's but it's very pervasive, and that the media, the video, everything is so in your face these days. It's hard to get away from it in many
mm-hmm.
ways. Now, on your album, getting back to our music for a minute, I love the second movement of this long piece, The Data Lords, you wrote, which I know was premiered about a year or two, more than that ago, at Newport, right? Yes.
Are you talking about the piece Don't Be Evil?
Yes.
Yeah, Don't Be Evil that was in 2017, exactly a year ago. It was early August.
Uh-huh.
We premiered that. That's my my mocking Google and their motto, Don't Be Evil.
I just want to play a little bit of the beginning of that because I could listen to that over and over in a loop. It is so cool. So it stopped. Well, okay. That's technology
okay.
for you. That's what happens when you try and copy a downloaded thing. But it just, oh, what a sound. Just the whole movement of that from that plinking chord to, I don't know how you get trumpets to hold their nose and play at the same time, but that seemed to be what
they did.
Yeah,
they're all playing harmon mutes and playing kind of with a lot of vibrato. I had them do that to make it more snarly and mocking.
Oh.
And then those little answers are all improvised by Jay Anderson on bass.
Yes.
And that's a bass trombone hitting those low tones together with, I think, piano.
And actually in some of the videos I saw and heard you developing that and went through a couple of permutations and it's great how each one is slightly different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's never but the menace of that intro is so wonderful, and it really.
Oh, thank you.
It's great. You know, when I saw you on the piano, or when I heard you on the video, I don't know if it's like this all the time, but we were plinking away in a very, very poorly tuned instrument.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Thanks. Yeah, I'm pretty bad about getting my piano tuned. And right now with COVID, I'm just like dying. Was that that upright piano in that Manhattan,
upright.
Right?
Yeah, that upright piano.
Yeah, that thing is really suffering, and I always have my windows open, so it's just, you know, it's a disaster. Yeah. I'd have to just.
Yeah, I didn't quite know. I mean, I knew you got the rhythm on it and the basics, but I didn't know if you'd really hear it the same. But it was in your head anyway, wasn't it?
Yes, it's in my head, even if it's out of tune.
That's it. Do you most of your composing that way, where you start on the piano and.
Yeah, the piano and just thinking things through in my head, you know, and it's a combination of everything. But the one thing I never use is the computer or any software.
Uh-huh.
I do everything pen and pencil, paper, sketches.
Right.
Always.
Okay.
Most composers now, you know, they do sort of digital representations of what they're writing.
Yes.
I don't, and the couple of times I've tried it, I've found it just hugely confusing, and I don't know, it's not for me.
That's all right. I once was in charge for a couple of years of a national competition for an orchestral composition, and this was a long time ago. The variety of scores that came in, everything from one page sort of roughed out with a repeat for a minimalist, to, the handwritten score that was 2 feet long and, you know, many pages, to the precision of the computer-generated stuff that some people do. It's very interesting, the various ways in which you can compose and put it down today. But
My music is very – it's a combination of very, very detailed, lots of intricacy.
Yeah.
But then I have, you know, these improvised sections where people solo in my band. But I, you know, unlike most people when they're studying jazz arranging, they love when it gets to the solo section because they can just write the chord changes and, you know, they're free of compositional responsibility. For me, it's really the opposite. I find writing the solo sections to be the most difficult part of my compositional process because it is so important to me that those improvised solos are a part of the sense of inevitability of the whole composition, yet it's an unknown factor.
Huh.
And so I have to try to find ways to build in certain things of where they're coming from, where they're going to, and certain landmarks in between to assure to some extent that we are all united in telling one story a different way every time, but with a certain high level of assurance that it's going to not go too far off the trail, you know?
That's interesting because, you know, there were times when I was listening and some of the soloists get pretty wild in this, you know. You have such control of the harmonies and all in the big sections. But I thought, boy, she really gives him a lot of space there.
Well, there's a couple of solos on this album that are freer than what I've ever done.
Yeah.
One is in CQCQ. That's a piece, CQCQ is anybody there.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is all the rhythms in that piece are Morse code. Power, greed, data, AI, SOS, help. and so, but the first soloist in it, Donnie McCaslin, his solo, I wanted it to be really open. And finally, in the end, we were really struggling because I didn't want it to sound somehow like free jazz. I wanted it to somehow feel evocative, that it was coming out of this world of all these little, you know, Morse code messages, almost like I was thinking about my dad when he used to dial in and you'd hear all the, and then you'd hear, you know, and the voices would be like split into harmonics coming through the the ether of Dad's waves and his radio towers. And then, you know, Donnie is supposed to be like this human voice coming out, but in a kind of a weird and odd way. And then he builds to this next solo that's all electronic, that's sort of like encountering artificial intelligence or something. And what we ended up doing after experimenting and none of us being satisfied is having just three people play, the drummer, Donnie, and the guitar player. So in terms of harmony, you only have two people. And when you only have two people improvising, like, you know, a guitarist and a horn player, it's very easy. I mean, it's not easy, but it's much easier for them to control where things are going, because you don't have suddenly three elements where they can be stepping all over each other. It's almost more like a conversation with two people, and the more people you have on the line, the harder it is to have a constructive conversation. And it's the same thing musically. So that section is quite free, but it took a lot of planning to figure out how to do it.
Well, that explains why, you know, I thought, wow, this is a little different. Is she really going off in a whole nother direction? But then you pulled it back, and I'm trying to pull it up here. I can't play it. I'll get a hold of the CD another time, and got plenty of time to play it. But and then towards the latter part of the CD, we went back to those very rich chording and the beautiful writing on that. So, hey, how did you learn orchestration?
Well, I studied with one of the greatest orchestration teachers I think that there are, and I just loved him. His name was Dominic Argento, very known for his operatic vocal songs. And I studied with him at the University of Minnesota. That was classical orchestration. And then I worked with Gil Evans, and
yes,
I just experiment a lot. You know, I don't know that I'm a great orchestrator, but I experiment a lot.
Well,
and you know, this album, because by the way, I'm going to send you the CDs so you have the physical product, but this album, you know, the download, it feels like it's all one recording, but it's actually two CDs.
Ah.
So the first CD is the digital world. It's, you know, everything inspired by everything from Google on Don't Be Evil to the world of ham radio, which and Morse code, which predated digital ones and zeros with longs and shorts, and to Sputnik, which is hearkening to the space race, but now that's between corporations sending thousands of satellites into space. So it's very, and then of course Data Lords at the very end, and then there's a piece of World Lost too that is about the loss of our inner world. But then the second CD is when you pull away from that and you reconnect to things in life, like, you know, nature, human contact, poetry, art, you know, just freedom of thought. And so those pieces, too, are based on Ted Kooser poetry. One is inspired by a piece of pottery by a man named Jack Troy that has a little stone inside of it. And I use the pottery on the piece.
Oh, you do?
One's inspired by a Zen or a temple garden north of Kyoto.
Huh.
And one's just simply called Look Up, meaning, you know, just look up and reconnect with this beautiful world. And so so the second CD is much more, more like my older music, I guess you could say.
Yes, yes. And I saw that progression. I thought, gee, this is interesting. And now I understand where I started with reading the dichotomy of the story of two worlds. The two CDs with a little bit of anger and angst, and the other with the appreciation of beauty, which is something, that's always struck me so wonderfully, that many of your earlier works talk about, you know, walking in the woods, listening to birds, looking at the stillness, or, you know, they're so rich. I had referred to them once when talking with you, but more like Debussy, you know, very evocative, impressionistic. And the second CD, I guess, just does go back to that, which is nice. It's good to have that grounding.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, the first CD, too, the music, one of the big influences that came into my life in the middle of, and that I think spurred a lot of that music, was my collaboration with David Bowie a few years back.
Yes.
In 2014, we collaborated on a song, Sewer, or In a Season of Crime, and it was recorded by my band, and he put it on a compilation CD of his called Nothing Has Changed.
Yes.
But he was really into my older, darker music, and he was really into, obviously, experimentation and everything, and it just kind of reopened a palette that was inside in me that had been maybe a little closed for a long time. And so I have to say, even if the first CD is dark or menacing in some ways, I also think it's really beautiful. I think it has fun and humor in it too. And I loved creating that music. I had fun creating that music. You know, I didn't sit and in a miserable state, angry, you know, at Big Data and, you know, and make myself miserable writing music. I sort of rejoiced in the expression of it, you know, the alchemy of turning all of that into something fun or beautiful, you know, whether it's through mockery or just trying to find a beautiful expression of something that is maybe scary.
Well, you can
face it. Music has done that for centuries. That's what music does. You know, it turns difficulty into beauty a lot of times.
Yeah, so I usually catch you when you're in New York at your residency at the Jazz Standard, I think, every November or something like that. And watching you while you're conducting the band, and the smile on your face always is, you know, that really shows the passion and the joy you get out of not only composing but hearing it played night after night. And it's
what I'm enjoying is not just, you know, hearing my music night after night, although, you know, sometimes I like hearing it, but what I really like hearing is the interpretation and the improvisation and what the rhythm section does and how they change it from night to night and from set to set. And what I think the audiences who have heard my band a lot or come to multiple nights know how much those performances can change. They know the level of creativity of these individuals, and they can see the smile and the surprise and the looks that everyone is giving each other when amazing, unexpected things happen. And I think that that is what you're keying into, really, is just the musicians all marveling at each other. And I think audiences enjoy seeing that. It's not them enjoying it, but seeing that the musicians themselves are in awe of each other, you know? And that's like a triple whammy fun experience, I think.
It is. It comes through, and I love seeing it. And I love seeing all these guys and gals. It's like crammed together. Boy, it's a tight space for a very large orchestra there to be heard.
Doesn't bode well to us playing this particular November in 2020 amidst COVID, does it? It's a bummer.
No, but maybe another. Look, November may bring a lot of changes in this world, I hope. I guess, well, maybe we can make up for it in the spring.
That's what I was actually talking to the Jazz Standard saying. Maybe we should try to plan something, you know, a half year later to kind of make it up, because it is the Thanksgiving week at the Standard has been something we've done for way over a decade now. And, you know, it's just, it's so sad. It's become such a an event that people come back for every year, and the band too. We love playing that gig.
Well, it shows, and whenever it is, I'll be there again. So, listen,
right.
I really appreciate your taking some time out. I know how busy you are these days and how this is going to land and be a big, big thing for you in many ways. And I'm looking forward to seeing you again whenever you're around in New York. So,
thank you so much. Me too.
Maria Schneider, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. I'm Richard Epstein at WPKN. And let's hear some other music of yours in the meanwhile. Walking by Flashlight, a poem originally by Ted Kooser, performed first by the Maria Schneider Orchestra off the Thompson Fields, which is the album just before Data Lords, of which we talked about a moment ago, and with Dawn Upshaw singing with the Australian Chamber Orchestra and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra from Maria's album of 2013, I guess, Winter Morning Walks. Just lovely stuff. We're WPKN in Bridgeport.